Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined this week by Jeremy Goldhorn, the man behind Danwei.com, back in Beijing this week. How are you, and how's it feel to be back, man?
It's great. I've been gorging myself on Beijing's finest cuisine, something I miss quite a lot in Tennessee.
I can imagine. So just give me two restaurants that you've eaten at. What was like the first place you had to rush off to?
Well, I'm staying right around the corner from Yuxin, which is a very nice Sichuan restaurant. And then aside from that, it's been hole in the wall.
Awesome. Have you tried that Shaanxi Mian place directly across from Yuxin?
No.
Make sure to try that. It's pretty amazing. So with the recent revival of rather old school and seemingly doctrinaire language that we're hearing emanating from Beijing in recent months, and of course with the 50th anniversary of the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution coming up very shortly, many people have begun taking a keen interest in Mao Zedong, in good old Chairman Mao, whose highly ambivalent and very problematic legacy still looms quite large over China. So today, we are joined by Jude Blanchette, who was formerly Assistant Director of the 21st Century China Program of the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego, and now works for the Conference Board. Let me add here that the views expressed by Jude here today do not represent or necessarily represent those of the Conference Board. So he's currently writing a book on neo-Maoism, on which I can't imagine the Conference Board has an opinion, but he's graciously accepted our invitation to come in and chat about Mao and the neo-Maoists. So Jude, welcome to Seneca, man.
Thank you, Kaiser. Thank you, Jeremy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, let me interrupt with a couple of items, sort of housekeeping stuff. I got to make a couple of announcements before we get into this very, very interesting conversation. First up, the Bookworm Literary Festival is coming up later in March here in Beijing, of course. I wanted to alert people to a couple of my picks for events during the festival that I think are going to be of particular interest to Seneca listeners. One, it will be kind of a double billing of David Bandersky, who, of course, is a researcher at the China Media Project down in Hong Kong. He's going to be talking about his new book, Dragons in Diamond Village, which looks at the phenomenon of urban villages. Anyway, the talk will be moderated by Josh Chin, who is, of course, an old friend of ours. It's based on a lot of research that was done in Shenzhen and a number of other Chinese cities. So right after that, actually, so that I think is at 2 p.m. on March 13th at 2 p.m. Right after that, David's going to do another session where he's going to be joining our former guest, Raymond Zhou Liming, to talk about journalism with Chinese characteristics, something which perhaps is especially salient right now as, you know, where the media is under increased scrutiny here in China. On Monday the 14th at 1 p.m., Arthur Krober will be chatting with the FT's Lucy Hornby. They've both, of course, been guests on our show about China's economy. That one you will not want to miss if you've been keen on hearing a very informed and sensible take on what is actually happening here in China with the economy. I guess on March 19th at 12 noon, I should add that I'm going to be actually on a panel with Edmund Lococo, who's a former Bloomberg tech reporter here in Beijing. He recently went over to the dark side. And by Christina Larson, who's science reporter extraordinaire and frequent guest on our program, to talk about innovation in China. And that is going to be moderated by, again, by Josh Chin from the Wall Street Journal, who I guess is going to be equally busy. And then we are taping, drumroll please, a special live edition of Seneca from the Bookworm Literary Festival, where David Moser and I will be talking to Melinda Liu. Melinda, who we've never actually had on the show, tried many times, but she's always, the stars never lie. Finally, longtime bureau chief for Newsweek and now the Daily Beast here in Beijing. We're going to be talking about the Cultural Revolution in observance of the 50th anniversary of the beginning of that fucking travesty. And last but not least, on May 27th, the last day of the festival, I will be playing Quizmaster in the Bookworm Literary Quiz, a literature quiz, which was a ton of fun last year, actually, and promises to be no less interesting again this time around. That will begin at 8 p.m. and is going to be free on March 27th. All the other events, I believe, are 50 yuan. Details are on the site at bookwormfestivalalloneword.com. So on to the show. Jude, let's start off with getting some definitions straight. How about, Jeremy, what do you think? Who are these Neo-Mao? What is Neo-Maoism, and who are we including in this movement, and what's a useful taxonomy? And maybe who aren't we including? Are we including the so-called New Left?
Yeah, so I think in popular discourse now, when we talk about the Neo-Maoists, we're essentially talking about a phenomenon of the past 15 or 16 years, sort of since 2001, entrance of the WTO, the internet, whatnot, which we can get to later. But that's in normal media discourse, that's who people are referring to. That's a good enough definition for newspaper articles. But I think when we're really talking in a meaningful sense of what is Neo-Maoism, we need to pull back the lens a little bit and rewind the phenomenon back at least 20, 25 years to the post-92 Southern Tour period.
Post-92 Southern Tour, I mean, I thought wasn't that the moment of triumph of neoliberalism?
Yeah, I think the way to think it about it is twofold. That's an okay narrative, and that generally gets, I think, the picture right. If we were to compare China in 76 and China today, that's probably what it looks like from a real 35,000-foot perspective. The problem is, that 35,000-foot perspective overlooks so much of what's important and what it leads up to this resurgence of Maoism today. So I think maybe just what I'll do briefly to help set the scene is just wind back the clock 3 decades, because that's really when this all kicks off. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I should say 4 decades. The moment that you had movement on the economic reform agenda is the moment you saw pushback. And that pushback continued until it became a movement. And the movement was it was sort of shunted to the side with various degrees of success, but it was never eradicated. So when I first started getting interested in Neo-Maoism around the time of Bo Xilai, and I started to pull the thread till I could get to the beginning of it, I kept pulling and pulling and pulling and pulling until I got to basically 1978, to the economic reforms. So a discussion of Neo-Maoism that starts in 09 or 010 or 2011, of course it will seem bizarre that these guys came out of nowhere. When you look at it from the lens of 40 years, what we've seen over the past sort of 5 or 6 years is just the continuation of a long conversation.
So when you define Neo-Maoism, who are we talking about exactly? Who would you define as a Neo-Maoist, in the 80s? And who are we talking about in the last decade?
Yeah, so I think the easiest way to understand this, because as with any, to some extent, fringe political movement, there's a narcissism of small differences. And if you get leftists in a room together, you're going to find so many gradations of leftism that it becomes confusing. But I think for our story, what we can really say is, in the decade after the 78 reforms, right? So December 1978 is the third plenum. That's when the big reform and opening package is unveiled. Opposition in the ensuing 10 years was what we'd call the conservatives. So these are people like Chen Yun. These are people like Hu Chaomu. These are people like Deng Lichun. So these are people who'd spent 50-odd years fighting for this revolution. Mm-hmm. And they were very rapidly seeing the dismantling of the state-owned economy, the reintroduction of what they call sort of bourgeois liberalism, spiritual pollution. Things that they'd literally fought for were being suddenly eradicated. So the pushback was a conservative pushback to conserve the institutions of the state-owned economy for that first decade.
Sure, but then they didn't have any champions, certainly not within the Central Committee, and certainly not within the Politburo by the, say, end of the 90s then.
Right. And this is where the flat narrative, which you gave at the beginning of, the rise of Deng, the triumph of the economic reforms, it overlooks what was always relatively intense opposition. And I think the sort of the post 89 period, the years right after that are a really good example of that. And that's where we see the blossoming of what was intra-party opposition move out to society in that period right after 89. So the narrative of Deng Xiaoping's Southern Tour, and if we can just do a quick potted history here, you have 89. It's a punch in the gut to the reformers because it's proving everything the conservatives were saying. You see, if you get this market, if you allow blue jeans, if you allow Coke, you get this spiritual pollution that'll infect the young people. And Deng Lichun has a quote, something to that effect. Mm-hmm. So Deng Xiaoping's prestige just...
It was Wranglers, though, and Pepsi.
Right, sorry. Deng Xiaoping's prestige just falls off rapidly in that period after 89. And that's where you had this Mao craze, which begun in 91, 92. You've got people flocking down to Shaoshan, which is Mao Zedong's hometown. So even if we look at the 92 Southern Tour, which was this triumphalist, you know, Deng leaves Beijing, goes down to the South and whips up support. That wasn't reported in any of the newspapers in Beijing for till the end of March. His trip ends in late February. It's not even reported to the end of March. Why? Because about half the standing committee was made up of Chen Yun and his conservatives. But again, I think for our discussion, that's elite politics, and that's not where it really gets interesting. It's this next phase.
And those, I mean, they're not really neo-Maoists. They're old Maoists.
We can call those people conservatives.
Okay.
Right?
So what about the bunch now? I mean, what do they want? I mean, what are they exactly after? Do they want to turn the clocks back? Are these guys, you know, are they Salafists? Are they purists? Are they, you know, wanting to reintroduce the people's communes? And
A very imprecise analogy, but one that I find myself constantly returning to is thinking of the neo-Maoists as sort of China's Tea Party. Except above the conservative right, it's of the far left, because there's a lot of parallels.
So Sanders. No, I'm joking. Yeah.
There's a lot of parallels in terms of the imagery that they adopt, the tactics they adopt, the fact that they are both astroturf and to some extent it's an organic movement. You see similar overlays with the Maoist movement. So if we were to, I think, succinctly in an elevator describe what the neo-Maoists are, it's not a matter of nostalgia in the sense of really wanting to go back to 1966 or 56. Any more than the Tea Party wants to return to. If you see a guy in a George Washington costume, he doesn't literally want to go back to 1776. What he's doing is he's adopting the best tool one has in an asymmetrical warfare with power to affect change, right? So,
which is what? Mythology.
Which is state mythology, right? So in the same way with a capital F, we've got the Founding Fathers, which I'm sure you've seen. You've now imbibed some of that in Tennessee.
I have indeed.
Mao is Jefferson here. So if you were to...
Wheezy or George?
If you were to look at what political weapon would you use to attack policy in the United States, one of the most effective ways is to wrap yourself in... I'm mixing my metaphors here, but wrap yourself in the flag of the Founding Fathers. Make it sound as if you're the real Founding Father. You're the inheritor of their legacy, right? Because that is the way that the country was founded by these individuals, and the discourse was primarily constructed around that. The same thing occurs here. If you are of the disaffected left, if you're of the powerless, whether it's labor, activists, what symbols will have the most impact? And of course, it's Mao.
Right.
And who are these people exactly? And when exactly did this current movement start?
Yeah, sorry. The only reason I'm hesitating to answer that question is you can really get in the weeds of this network.
But like the major ones, are we talking Utopia?
Okay. Let you if you go to.
So let me start with the one I think most people know about because that was my entry into this discussion. And that's Utopia, right? And
Jeremy, you followed quite a bit about Utopia's vicissitudes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But go ahead, Jude.
And Utopia is how this book idea started, with just understanding Utopia, and of course, as these things do, it built and built and built.
But the Chinese name of Utopia,
Wuyou Zhixiang, which is a Wutuobang is how you say Utopia in Chinese, and so this is a play on that. So the Utopia that I think most of us know came out of this 2011 feud with a guy named Mao Yushi, who'd written an article criticizing Mao Zedong pretty vehemently.
Okay, so Mao Yushu, for people who don't know, he's a very – now he's now in octo – oh, no, he's
85,
a,
I think.
No, he's – is he close to 90? Okay,
85. 85
or 86. All right, yeah, an older guy, an economist. Has some pretty radical ideas. For example, he does not believe in Chinese food security, believes that China should import a significant proportion of its food needs. But he's also one of the most rabidly outspoken, I don't hesitate to call him a kind of a neoliberal opponent of, right, okay. So we know who this guy is, right, everyone?
So after he writes this article, this what I can only say is Cultural Revolution style campaign organized by Utopia springs up around the country, where you have these criticism sessions with banners saying take down the Han Jian, I don't know if you'd say race traitor, but take down the traitor of Mao Yushu. So that's how I initially got interested in understanding what is this group, because my understanding of China at that point was capitalism, WTO, nobody believes in communism anymore, and then you saw this rabid group of communists. So Utopia started in 2003, and that's not an accident that it was 2003. A lot of the neo-Maoist movement started that year.
What was significant about 2003 then?
If you think about that as being the one end, one bookend, and sort of 98, 97 being the other, you had a whole series of events which, if you're someone who believes in socialism and socialist institutions, you'd feel very unnerved. You had the SOE privatization under Zhu Rongji. You had the U.S. bombing of NATO bombing of the embassy in Belgrade. You had in 99. You had, beginning around that period, negotiations and then finally entrance into the WTO in 2001. You had the Sangha Daibyo, which allowed capitalists into the CCP. And for some of these people, the final straw was the shuttering of two really important leftist journals had for about 10 years since the post-89 period been one of the primary vehicles for voices of the far left. Ordinarily, I think if this had happened 10 years earlier, that might have been the end of the story. But something else was happening around 2002, 2003, which Kaiser knows very well. This is when the internet started to be adopted.
Jeremy knows it as well. He started. When did you start?
2003. Yeah, Dan Wei was started, right. And it was called Dan Wei because were neo-Maoists.
A conversation I had with a group called Mao Flag, which was also started in 2003 by these old cadres who'd been fed up. They said essentially they were dispirited about all that was happening, but they had this young guy they knew who said, "You know what? There's this internet thing we can try." And as someone has likened it to since, this is the new Dazibao. This was the new way of speaking truth to power. But unlike how I think many of us in the West, and if you go back and read a lot of the coverage of that time, thought this was going to be this universal acid for eating away at all these end of history ideologies. In fact, it resuscitated the left.
Right. And yet they have suffered a lot. I mean, they have gone through many ups and downs. Where have they congregated besides the Utopia websites, besides
Mao Flag?
Mao Flag.
Yeah, there's redchina.cn was the other one, right?
There's a whole large constellation of what they call red websites, Hongshuangjian, which exist. Some of them are fairly visible. There's one called the Red Song Society, which to me looks sort of like the Drudge Report of Maoist websites. It's sort of an aggregator of what's happening in the Maoist scene. But there's Xin Gongren is one. There's Zheng Dao, which is run by Han Dechang. It's his commune out in Hebei. There's Hao Dashui, which is a education website, but is pushing sort of Maoist education.
So I remember when we were talking earlier, you had this sort of taxonomy of them that actually drew on the old Cultural Revolution era taxonomies of the Zaofanpai and the Baohuangpai. Can you break that? So Zaofan is to fuck shit up.
To rebel is right. Zaofan Youli.
Zaofan Youli.
It's another interesting thing about when you begin to pull this thread on the Maoists, you find that just lumping them together as neo-Maoists isn't entirely helpful because you see two essentially big splits in the movement.
Okay.
And that's why I use the taxonomy of the sort of the royalists, the Baohuangpai and the Zaofanpai.
So, unpack that. So what is the Baohuangpai?
So the Baohuangpai would be the Maoist for who their Mao is the nationalist Mao. This is a man who within a year of the founding of the PRC, stared down the United States and Korea. This is the Mao who gets the atomic bomb. This is the Mao who humiliates Khrushchev in the swimming pool of Zhongnanhai in 58 or 59, whenever the visit was.
I don't know how familiar people are with that story. Jeremy, you want to tell that one? You're, as our resident explainer.
I'm not sure if I'm the best person to tell that particular story, but I think perhaps Jude could.
The quick version is
and this comes from Li Zhishui. This comes from
No, this is a celebrated, well-known story.
I encountered it there.
So you have after 56, 57, essentially after Khrushchev's secret speech in 56 denouncing Stalin's crime, which Mao took personally, you have the split, the Sino-Soviet split begin. And Mao is now starting to feel his oats. You've got the first 5-year plan is in gear. Successfully they've done land reform a couple years earlier. He's finally starting to feel pretty confident. So Khrushchev comes to Beijing, and Mao, who was a constant swimmer throughout his life and quite a strong swimmer, had a swimming pool built right next to his compound. And so he insists that his meeting with Khrushchev is held in the swimming pool because he knows Khrushchev can't swim. And so you have Mao gracefully gliding around. You have a Khrushchev, splashing around like a doggy paddling. So, for the royalists, that is the Mao, and that's their narrative. It's a Fuchang narrative. This is a guy who ended the century of humiliation. So to fast forward,
and there's much ideological content to them beyond that Mao is a symbol of. So they're not necessarily doctrinaire.
No, they are. I'm just trying to simplify it to the real essential bit. And so that's where we get to their relationship vis-a-vis the CCP. The CCP is the only thing standing between China and foreign invasion that could be via financial markets, capitalism, that could be actually a physical invasion. So for them, it's a matter of even if you see the CCP erring, that is still the CCP is China, is the PRC. It's Mao's. Great inheritance.
And essentially you're loyal to the party above ideology.
But so they wouldn't have batted an eye when Bo Xilai went down. Their loyalties weren't then.
It's a little bit complicated, but sure, if we want to flatten the narrative a little bit, sure. Yeah, I think we can say that it's the CCP above all. Then we've got something called the Zaofan Pai. These are the more active.
This is your name or their name or other people's names for them?
This is my way of thinking of this, borrowing from the Cultural Revolution. This was the famous split in the Cultural Revolution of the Red Guards.
But do they kind of self-consciously adopt these names? No.
Okay.
All right. Just making sure that we understand that.
So the Zaofan Pai, the rebel faction, are the activists. These are the people who aren't in Beijing, who are in cities like Zhengzhou, Shenyang, cities that were decimated by the SOE reforms. That's where they started. And these are the people for whom the CCP has sort of given up its ideological origins, and it can't be saved. So these are the people who I think are much more activists. These are the people who are doing underground meetings.
They're threatening to the regime. Speaking of underground meetings.
So JinBoucher.org, I guess, was one of those.
Yeah, JinBoucher
was.
They went
on a campaign against Wen Jiabao, accusing him of being a traitor.
They actually, there was a petition going around just before Wen Jiabao stepped down in 2012 that was calling for his sacking. And this is one that was circulating all the red websites and was getting signatures. It's since been scrubbed. But that was a pretty remarkable. The rules that I understood of Chinese politics said that shouldn't, or if that happened, all those groups should be shut down immediately, yet they weren't.
And
JinBoucher.org was the website that had its logo was a AK-47 toting panda, which was rather charming.
And their subsidiary website was called Sinu, so Western slaves.
Do you remember?
I featured on Sinu with a noose around my neck as a traitor to the Chinese race, which rather pleased me as I didn't realize I was a member of it. But can we go back to Bo Xilai, the question of Bo Xilai, because that changed a lot for many of these websites. Many of them actually closed down. In fact, most of them, as far as I understand, closed down. Can you explain what happened to the neo-Maoists during the fall of Bo Xilai and which of them managed to rise up again after it?
When Bo Xilai goes to Chongqing, there was an immediate recognition, I think, by the Maoist, neo-Maoist left, that this was somebody with whom they could support. They knew they could ride his coattails, and there was a real belief that Bo Xilai had a shot of getting into the standing committee. So Utopia started to make pilgrimages out to Chongqing. Yeah. Sima Nan, who's affiliated with Utopia, was famously photographed with Wang Lijun.
Sima Nan, when we come up with a name, so he is a Baohuang Pai, right?
Absolutely. Sort of well-known debunker of non-scientific claims,
right,
but that's
James
one hat.
Randi of China.
James Randi of China, right. But also a fervent Baohuang Pai.
Yeah.
So a lot of the...
And that unfortunate escalator accident, too, let us not forget.
A lot of the red websites threw their lot in with Bo Xilai. And this is also the same period you had this campaign against Mao Yushir. So really a lot of journalists in the West were starting to take notice of this crazy phenomenon that was happening. When the whole Bo Xilai thing fell apart, on the day that they announced his loss of his party membership in whenever the Lianghui was in 2012.
In March.
That same day, all of the red websites, that same day, all of them were shuttered. All of them were closed. And I think for most of us, that was the end of the story. That was clearly the center indicating that this had gone too far. And you remember Wen Jiabao in that final press conference said, we need to worry about a return to the Cultural Revolution. The Cultural Revolution being this great almost boogeyman, you know, like a parent telling their kid, you know, go to bed or the Cultural Revolution will come back. It's used by a lot of people a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's used constantly here.
So all those websites shut down. I think for everyone, that was the end of the story. But something interesting really happened. After shutting down for about 6 months, September 9th is the anniversary of Mao's death, which, by the way, is the 40th anniversary this year, September 9th.
It's quite a year for anniversaries.
It sure is.
10 minutes after midnight. So on that occasion, Utopia had typically done a big gala, and yet again they do it this year. And at this big gala are Zhang Chunjing, who was the head of the organization department during the 1990s. Hu Chaomu's daughter, Hu Muying, was at this big thing. She's a president of something called Children of Yan'an, sort of a Hong Ar Dai organization.
The true red royalty. Still loyal red royalty. Right?
So you all of a sudden have these organizations coming back one by one and slowly. And to this day, they still exist. And I this is not a great analogy, but I always sort of think it was like Obi-Wan Kenobi being struck down.
More powerful.
And so they have in many ways multiplied, become more sophisticated. Their activities have expanded. You know, Utopia was primarily a bookstore with an occasional meeting. Now it's got a very popular website, which is their Wangkan, their online newspaper. They do red tourism.
Which suggests to me that Xi Jinping sees some use in having these people around still. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, this is where maybe I could just quickly rewind a little bit, because the reason that the left is still a thing in China and the reason that it hasn't gone away is because there's always been this fundamental contradiction for the CCP. It preaches socialism and it practices capitalism. And as long as you preach socialism,
Mao is useful.
Mao is useful for the CCP, but also that provides a space for people to the left of the CCP to constantly be entering the conversation. And so Deng, you know, made a decision very early on that he couldn't entirely do without the left. And if you read his successive drafts, comments on the 1981 resolution, which is the historical resolution, which sort of said Mao is pretty bad, but he did mostly good things.
It wasn't the 70-30 resolution?
Right, which an interesting thing I learned, and I'd always thought that the 70-30, Mao is 70% good, 30% bad, was in the 81 resolution, and it's not.
It's not.
No, it's not. The 70-30 formulation was something that had been used often. Mao had used it himself to evaluate Stalin. Mao had used it again himself to Deng Xiaoping to evaluate his merits and demerits. He'd used it in evaluating the Cultural Revolution. In January of 79, at this what's called the Theory Conference, a few people in the meeting brought it up as being a way to evaluate the Cultural Revolution. But it was never an official position. It's never in any official document.
Huh.
But it's been one of these things. I think it was quite convenient for us to make sense of it all.
I've got to go back and change one of my Quora answers.
So, you know, as long as part of the legitimizing narrative is this left socialist narrative, the left will always be an element of the discourse in China, and they've never been able to eradicate that.
So if we look at utopia today, I mean, you know, they suffered after the fall of Bo Xilai. Have they forgiven the party, and has the party forgiven them, and they are now back, you know,
in good graces
with the establishment? And I ask also particularly in the context of a few days ago, the Weibo, the microblog of Ren Zhiqiang, the real estate billionaire with 37 billion followers, who
37
is,
million.
A million, sorry.
Yeah. and only $22 million.
His Weibo account was deleted after he criticized basically Xi Jinping's media campaign to bring the major state media completely under his control.
Hard to say that was an
just let me finish, Kaiser. Utopia today on their homepage, there were no fewer than 36 stories attacking Ren Zhiqiang. Have they come back into the fold of the establishment?
Yeah, I think I was hoping someone would observe that it's the past day has been entirely about Ren Zhiqiang and how he's anti-party. I think two things. I wouldn't take that necessarily as a sign that everybody at Utopia is pro-Xi. I would take that as a sign as they don't recognize the right of anyone other than their club to be criticizing the party. So it's anyone who is a historical nihilist, anyone who is a flirting with global capitalism, anyone who is a Western slave, those people do not have the right, as far as Utopia is concerned, to be making comments other than slavishly pro-party.
So it's kind of like we Jews are the only people allowed to tell anti-Semitic jokes. Is that...
Right. So I wouldn't take that entirely because there is a few people who are part of this Bao Huang Pai have subsequently left Utopia. Zhang Hongliang, who's at Minzu Dashui and is Minorities University and mm-hmm. is one of the most prominent Bao Huang Pai and who was instrumental in moving Utopia from being a more generally pan-leftist organization in about 2008 into an explicitly Maoist organization. He is subsequently broken with Utopia because he thinks they've gone off the rails a little bit.
Off the rails in what sense?
Extremism, not adhering to the Fuxing line, which is Zhang Hongliang's nationalist project, not recognizing that Xi is the greatest instrument for bringing about the revitalization of the Chinese nation.
So off the rails by being too critical of Xi. That's very interesting. Where does the new left fit into your taxonomy, the so-called new left? Because I think I'm worried that a lot of people are lumping them in when I personally don't believe they deserve to be.
Yeah, the new left was always a distinct movement from what we call neo-Maoism. There was, you know, when we think of the most obvious people, the new left, we're primarily thinking of people who were educated abroad. A lot of them, Cui Zhiyuan,
Wang Hui,
and then who have a distinct mix of social democratic sympathy mm-hmm. With a heightened concern about global capitalism. So these are not people, they would say they're pro-democracy, they're pro-welfare state.
Right. They're statist to some extent.
They're statist certainly to some extent, right? So they've always been a shared that the left space with the Maoists, but they've never been the same same creature.
They're much more ambivalent about Mao himself.
Although I know Cui Zhiyuan has written several articles praising the Cultural Revolution legacy as being an important example of the people being able to speak truth to power. But in general, yes, I'd say there's people like Wang Hui I know are not going to wholesale criticize Mao in the way that someone like Mao Yushu would be, mm-hmm. but have a much more, I think, ambivalent legacy or ambivalent opinion about the Cultural Revolution and Mao.
What about mainstream appeal of these people? Because, I mean, I can understand that it's a powerful force because in a country that still defines itself as communist, if you are a self-proclaimed communist and a leftist and a Maoist, you know, your voice has a certain, you know, Hua Yuquan, you have a certain authority to speak. But is it at all popular?
Especially when, you know, that symbol that is being used is still so ubiquitous, right? I mean, it hasn't been invalidated.
The symbol of Mao.
Mao himself.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I think the straight answer is we don't know because we have no way of really assessing.
Because there are no elections.
There have been surveys that have been done. One of the first ones was done by Andrew Nathan in 1990, where they went out and polled on. Basically, think of Mao as being the opposite. Pro-Mao is often the opposite of pro-reform. So you can – an answer that is pro-Mao is often just basically saying you're not for the capitalist reforms, which was what Andrew Nathan was measuring in 1990.
Yeah, see, but I don't believe that that's a straight-up dichotomy. I mean,
totally.
A perfect dyad at all.
Totally. Yeah. So the problem is this space gets a little bit messy because there's not exactly two.
So is that something you're trying to look at though in your book? Is you know Jeremy's question about what is the broad popular appeal of this left?
And what's your gut feeling? I mean, no empirical evidence. Just what's your gut feeling?
I'm not going to spend time doing that because I just don't have the tools and I don't to go out and make any meaningful measure of how much support for. So we'd have to make a distinguish between Mao, neo-Maoism as a movement and Mao as an individual.
But to all you graduate students out there listening, I mean, this is a very good research topic, is it not? I mean, and what explains then the dearth of academic interest in this? I don't see a lot of people, especially in Western academia, writing about this particular topic.
You know, there is some really good research going on right now about ideology in China, and I know you had you did an episode on the paper by Jen Pan and Shui Qing.
Yeah,
and there's a great grad student at UCSD named Jason Wu doing stuff on ideology and trying to better understand, better map out the ideological contours, moving beyond simply saying left and right. Right is you are pro-constitutionalism and pro-capitalism, left is you're a socialist.
Right.
Because maybe that's not the right way to define left and right, not the best way to define left and right in China. I just to quickly return to Jeremy's question, I don't know, but my sense is it's always been a support for Mao has always been a side effect of dissatisfaction with the direction of China. And so you've seen waves of this come and go where low points in the belief and faith in the direction of that China is going, you see an upsurge in Mao nostalgia or pro-Maoism.
I think your Tea Party analogy.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think this is where the forget Bo Xilai for a minute. I think one of the interesting things that took me by surprise and a lot of people was just how organically popular this Singing Red nostalgic campaign was. And there was certainly an element of astroturfing to it or promotion by the CCP. But that doesn't, to me, explain most of what was happening then. I really think there was
tapped into something and organic.
Because the other thing is, there is no right as a movement in China that resonates with anybody. And I think we get all excited when we find some of these individuals who closely map what we want. And I think these people are important. I'm not saying that at all. I think what they're doing is amazing. But I think if we were to...
A stunning admission from an imperialist such as you.
If we were to go out and have the ability to see if people are sympathetic with a quote-unquote rightist agenda, I think we'd find much less support once we get out of... And this is what the Jen Pan Shui Qing thing essentially said, is when you move inland, you find more conservatism.
Right, just like in America.
Well, yeah, and for similar reasons, poorer people more threatened by change. Right?
So we've talked a lot about on this show about how interpretation of history is really one of the main preoccupations of politics here in China. The place just abounds in contested narratives, and in fact, we're going to be speaking with a blogger, Ma Tianjie, pretty soon, about, among other things, that excellent essay that he wrote about historical nihilism. You brought up the phrase historical nihilism not 10 minutes ago. Let's talk about how that idea has entered into the ongoing debates between it among these different neo-Maoist factions and their detractors, both within the establishment and also on the non-establishment right, insofar as it exists at all. With regard to like Yanwang Chunqiu, there's that piece that attacks the mythology of the five heroes of Wolf Tooth Mountain of or Langyangshan. Jeremy, turn to the explainer, Yinhuang Chunqiu, in 30 seconds or less?
A magazine run by a bunch of old people who favor liberal policies.
Okay, good enough.
And usually stay out of trouble, but not always.
Yeah. Yang Jisheng, who wrote the book Tombstone, is one of the editors there.
Right, yeah.
So this is I think, so interesting that I'm devoting an entire chapter to it. Essentially, there's a lawsuit, which the appeal, by the way, which I'll get to in a minute, was just announced today. On the blog of one of the important people in this. But
today is March 1st, by the way, the day of the taping. So that's why, you know, if
or just wait and read my book and I'll tell you about it. I think a lot of people have seen this phrase, historical nihilism, come up repeatedly. And if you do keyword searches of People's Daily, you see it didn't exist in 5 years ago, and now you're seeing it quite a lot. You're seeing stuff come out of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. You're really seeing a big official push on this. And what essentially, I think, if we want to define historical nihilism as it's used in the popular narrative now, it's basically
the party line on history.
If you don't toe the party line on history, you're a historical nihilist. If you have an independent reading of what happened in China's revolutionary past. So in November 2013, and I'm going to skip over a lot of these details because it takes too long, but Yinhuang Chunqiu published an article on the five heroes of Longyao Mountain, which is a battle in 1941 during the Sino-Japanese War. These five heroes of the 8th Route Army basically tricked the Japanese into thinking they were this entire mass of troops. And so they spread out on a mountain and they fought valiantly as the 8th Route Army could make its escape. Before they were captured, all five of them flung themselves off the side of Longyao Mountain so that they would not give any information to the Japanese. And that was made into a movie in 1958. It's become just one of the pieces of the revolutionary history, especially the revolutionary history during the Sino-Japanese War, which is now is coming to the fore again over the past couple of years. So knowing exactly what they're doing, Yinhuang Chunqiu publishes an article saying, you know what? A lot of the details about this story aren't quite right. If you look at eyewitness testimony, these stories don't match up, blah, 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 blah. A couple days later, two prominent neo-Maoists go to Weibo, back when Weibo was a thing, and they say essentially, they call them SOBs, and they, in one of them, Guo Songmin, who's an ex-Air Force captain, who's a utopia guy, calls him a historical nihilist. Actually, he says, fight historical nihilism. He doesn't say
who
was.
Address it directly to the.
And in something that was really
a good case for libel, but,
right. And in something that really surprised me for Yinhuang Chunqiu, their lawyer dispatched a letter to Mei Xinyu and Guo Songmin. These two guys had written these Weibo posts suing them on behalf of the author of the article and the editor of the article at Yinhuang Chunqiu, suing them for libel.
Wow.
And forget about the details of the court case, which dragged on for a year and a half. This became a cause celeb within the. I mean, this was great, right? It was the right, including Yang Jisheng, who'd written this book slandering Mao by saying 40 million people had died in the Great Leap Forward, against the left, who were fighting to preserve the memory of the martyrs who'd fought for communism and for the great Chinese nation, battling each other in the Beijing courts. And what everyone wanted to know is, how the heck is the court going to rule? Because what they're ruling on is the revolution, who has the right to speak about history, what is historical nihilism. We know there's going to be a verdict in December of last year. Everyone can feel it. There's strategy sessions going on. There's forums. Well, right before the announcement comes on the case, two of the sons of the five martyrs then sue Yinhuang Chunqiu for slandering their father. So finally, end of December, verdict comes out in favor of Guo Songmin and Mei Xinyu, who had called these two guys historical nihilists.
That's
and the
good.
Court document yeah. says that Yinhuang Chunqiu had, I forget the exact wording, but something like violated the historical memory of the Chinese people, something to that effect, but had weighed in on it. And then there's been a countersuit, and today it just came out that Guo Songmin won again after this appeal by Yinhuang Chunqiu. But what was interesting for me is just this shows how history, more so than even the United States, is the battleground for a proxy war.
Right.
And
right.
that when you're talking
what's,
about
what's the, a good analogy from American history? I mean, the same Paul Revere never did say the British are coming, or you know, I mean, what?
Yeah, the only one I use often is, if you remember, in 2003, 2004, a book came out saying that Thomas Jefferson had fathered a child with Sally Hemings.
Yeah.
And the right in America went apoplectic.
Yeah.
And to some extent, the details didn't matter. If you slander Thomas Jefferson, the founding father, you slander America. If you slander America, you slander us.
Good.
And so it's not a perfect analogy, but I think you can see some of the intuition about why the neo-Maoists are so dead set on saying this is ground you cannot come. We don't want roving independent historians poking details in our revolutionary
narrative.
This is
a holy story.
And they're actually called holy sites when you go to these.
Shengdi.
I guess I want to turn quickly to Jeremy and ask you. I mean, so we talked about now this, the legacy of Mao is a serious double-edged sword that the party is obliged now to carry before it. Jeremy, how does this play out? I mean, how dangerous? No, seriously. I mean, what happens to the legacy of Mao? I mean, can we bury Mao?
I don't think it's possible to bury Mao. In is it? I mean, he's on the money. He's on in the middle of Tiananmen Square. He's on Tiananmen itself. How can you do away with any of that without destroying any of the mythology of the party? I mean, wouldn't you agree, Jude? I mean, this is the trap that the party finds itself in, is that what can you do with Mao? Nothing.
Yeah, the you know.
And then you're forever obliged to defend.
Yeah, my line on Mao is he is both the most important figure and the most dangerous figure to the CCP. He's the most important figure because, especially as we're seeing economic growth rates decline and it's returning back to this, you know, the Yan'an spirit, it's time during the Sino-Japanese War. Mao is still the turf upon which it's planted. I'm mixing metaphors here, but it's legitimacy stake. I mean, he is the single most important historical figure of the past century to the CCP. On the other hand, if you take Maoism seriously, if you really look at Maoism, it's the opposite of Wei Wen. It's storm the barricades. It's permanent revolution. It's making sure there's no restoration of capitalism. It's the spirit of the Cultural Revolution. It's the Dazibao. It's all these things. So what the CCP is trying to do is this Goldilocks, fence-walking, knife's edge.
Wow,
of,
that's three metaphors.
Of just enough Maoism to keep the whole thing running, but not too much Maoism or not independent Maoism. And that's one of the reasons that I think we're going to see more Maoism, because one of the ways you shut off narratives.
Not Mao more than ever, but more Mao than
more
ever.
More Mao than ever, right. Is you flood the conversation with your Mao.
And that's what's been happening even just this week, hasn't it, with what was going on with Xi Jinping?
So it was an old report, old work report of Mao's that has now been, all the party cadres have been told they need to study it. You know, on the 120th anniversary of Mao's birth in 2013, they put a 100-episode serialization of his life on CCTV. Mm. You know, I think... if you leave Mao to his own devices, it festers like a sore. So you need to flood the airwaves with your Mao and make sure that that's the Mao that we're all paying attention to. Then Mao the nationalist, not Mao the radical.
Fascinating, fascinating. And we look forward to reading your book, absolutely, and to having you back on the show.
Thank you.
Talk about this and other things. Jeremy, it's time to move to recommendations.
Sure. I've got one that's very relevant to the theme of our podcast today, which is something, full disclosure, I published on Dunway.com a few years ago by Robert Foyle Hanwick, which was an interview with...
Fan Jingang.
One of the Utopia bookstore and website founders. And this was shortly after the website had been shuttered after the fall of Bo Xilai. And it's quite an interesting little interview.
Mm-hmm. So Robert Foyle Hanwick's interview with Fan Jingang.
Okay. That's right.
Excellent, excellent. Jude, what do you have for us this week?
I've got a great book by one of my favorite historians of modern China, Maurice Meisner.
Of Wisconsin.
M-E-I-S-N-E-R, and it's called The Deng Xiaoping Era, An Enquiry into the Fate of Socialism, that from a fairly hardcore left position looks at what Deng hath wrought during the late 70s, early 80s, and up to his death. It's a beautifully written book.
Is Meisner still alive?
No, he's dead.
He passed.
But he's but that and his general history of
Mao's China and after
are just some of the best written, enjoyable work on China.
Beautiful, beautiful. I mean, I that was my undergraduate textbook on Mao is Mao's China, and then Mao's China and after I read again in grad school. Great recommendations. Yeah, I mean, I think Meisner is underread these days. That's really unfortunate. My recommendation actually comes from you, Jude. You flashed a book at me that I immediately rushed out and bought on Kindle and started reading, by Lyle J. Goldstein, rather. I'm sorry. Meeting China
Goldstein
Halfway.
Goldman.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know what? Just to prevent the charge of anti-Semitism, I'm going to re-record that line. Okay. Laugh away. I had so much trouble remembering his name, though. Seriously, I had a lot of trouble remembering.
Goldstein.
Goldberg. Okay. Yeah, so Lyle J. Goldstein, Meeting China Halfway, which is... so he teaches at the Naval War College, and he's written pieces where from which I concluded that he was quite a hawk. And if you read this book, at least as I've read it so far, it's really, really kind of shocking. The you know, the his prescriptions for the avoidance of the Thucydides trap, really kind of bringing back spheres of influence, granting China significant spheres of influence, you know, in the East China Sea, pulling back on close surveillance on you know, EP3s and that sort of thing, and then engaging China in what he calls sort of spirals of oh gosh, I'm not going to remember it. And I'm only 20-30 pages in, but it's already fascinating. And I'm hoping that I'm recommending something that is going to stay this sane through to the end, that he doesn't end up pulling in something completely batshit crazy and indefensible. Because I have not read the whole book yet, but I'm going to provisionally recommend it. And hope, Professor Goldstein, if you're listening, that first of all, you accept my humblest apology for mispronouncing your name. I am not, I assure you. And also that you'll reach out, and I would love to have you on the show to talk about this. And so thanks, Jude. Jude, thanks, and it's great to have you back in Beijing, and we look forward to hanging out a lot.
Thank you very much.
Jeremy, man?
Yeah, thanks, Jude. Thanks, Kaiser.
All right, and take care. We will see you next week on the Seneca Podcast. Bye-bye.